Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's the 9th of June, 2012, and today I'm talking to William Hathaway, a Special Forces combat veteran turned peace activist whose first book, A World of Hurt, won a Reinhardt Foundation Award for its portrayal of the psychological roots of war. He has since left the U.S. to avoid arrest for his anti-war activities and is now an adjunct professor of American Studies at the University of Oldenburg in Germany, and his writings are available at peacewriter.org. His latest book, Radical Peace, People Refusing War, was recently published by Trinde and is a journey along diverse paths of nonviolence, the true stories of people working for peace in unconventional ways. So, William Hathaway, it's great to have you on the program today. Thanks for joining us.
It's nice to be here. We're really speaking halfway across the world. And both of us are expatriates now.
That's right.
You're Canadian in Japan, and I'm a U.S. American in Germany.
That's right. And we're probably speaking to people all around the world. So
wonderful.
It's a marvelous age to live in many respects. Well, let's start with some of the background that I was talking about there to introduce you. Before we get into the book, which obviously I want to talk about, let's talk a little bit about your own background and your journey that has led you to Germany and to your current work.
Yeah, I started out as a newspaper reporter in San Francisco and wanted to write a book, though. And so I joined the Special Forces to write a book about war. After I was actually in the war, this began to seem like a pretty foolish thing that I'd done. In the midst of our search and destroy operations, I kept telling myself, look, I'm just here gathering material for a book. But unfortunately, our deeds have ways of sticking to us and affecting us and other people, regardless of why we do them. I was sort of deluding myself that I was this subjective observer, and I was actually part of an extremely destructive, negative operation on the part of the United States in trying to conquer another part of the world. And since then, I've written, published four books on the topic of violence, and the latest is Radical Peace, about the resistance movement to it, the active resistance movement that's going on.
Well, that certainly is a long way to go to get material for a book. So perhaps we can talk a little bit about how that affected, shaped, or influenced your general thoughts on peace and what violence is really all about.
Well, it made it clear about how useless and how futile it is to try to kill people in the name of peace. It made me also realize that the purposes of the war were totally false that were stated to us. It wasn't to save South Vietnam or preserve it for democracy or anything else like that, just like we're not fighting now in Iraq and Afghanistan to bring them democracy and freedom. We're there to control their resources. I began to see this as a worldwide pattern that the United States and its allies, is not just the United States, but certainly now it's emerging more. The whole NATO alliance is becoming a bloc, an imperialist bloc that's now now out to conquer Syria and after that Iran and control those resources. And so then I began to feel I need to do something about this and try to stop it.
Unfortunately, true, and certainly I think a lot of people are realizing now that NATO is becoming part of that that power block, the really just an extension of what seems to be American imperial conquest or neo-imperialist conquest around the world. And unfortunately, you're still, I guess, under that umbrella there in Germany, so it's difficult to escape from under that. But let's talk about that move to Germany.
Germany
and how
is
that
very much a junior partner in all this, just like France and Britain. Britain are, and they go along with it. They try in some ways to distance themselves from it a little bit, but they're definitely players in this game.
Unfortunately, so let's talk about the most recent book again, Radical Peace, People Refusing War. Tell us about how this book came together and what it entails.
Well, I wrote it to convince people, including myself, not to give up on their efforts to change the United States, to change the countries we live in. so many people have retreated into apathy and futility after Obama continued the war that he pledged to stop. And now our disappointment is just turning into despair. He managed to just basically put the peace movement to sleep. And he's gone on then to show that he's just another imperialist, just like George Bush. He's killing thousands of people just to maintain U.S. power in Iraq and Afghanistan. And a similar betrayal, he's not the first time this happened. In 2006, the Democrats gained control of Congress by pledging to end the war. But then a few months later, those same politicians voted a huge increase in military spending and supported the U.S. troop surges. And this all made it clear to me that voters don't control our government. The corporations do. And that's true in the United States. It's true in Canada. It's true in Japan, too, unfortunately, and in most of the world. Governments represent business and not us. And if business needs cheap oil, the president and Congress are willing to make war to get it. And every few years, they'll take time out for some campaign rhetoric about peace. But it's obvious now that rhetoric just lies. So these swindles have led to a voter rejection of both parties. Now that it's clear that elections and demonstrations and petitions have just failed, so people are searching for alternative ways to end war. And radical peace portrays two very different groups who found other paths to change, to social change and to peace. The first group are militant activists who have given up on legal methods and become domestic insurgents. They're determined to bring the U.S. political and economic system down through a program of sedition, subversion, and sabotage. They're destroying computer systems. They're helping soldiers to desert. They're trashing recruiting offices, burning military equipment, and sabotaging defense contractors. These are hardcore. They're criminals. They've become criminals for peace. They're defying the Patriot Act, and they work underground in secret cells to undermine the military empire. And radical peace takes us into their lives. It portrays different people. One of the people that portrays it, his code name is Trucker, and he's committed to aggressive forms of resistance, such as destroying government property. His specialty is burning military vehicles. He drives around and seeks out military vehicles that are left out, exposed overnight, at National Guard units. If the situation is right and he can get away, he sets them on fire. And takes us into his life and why he did this. He's an old friend of mine from the from peace demonstration days. And he was badly beaten by the police and then charged with attacking them. This quite often happens that the police will beat up somebody, and then, of course, they look all bruised and bloody. And to explain for that, the police say, he attacked us, and we had to defend ourselves. And attacking the police is a quite serious crime, and he was sentenced to several months in prison for this. It made him bitter, and he got more radical after that. It also portrays a woman soldier who was raped by a fellow GI in Iraq. And her commanding officer refused to prosecute the rapist and threatened her with disciplinary action if she made trouble, you know. Just shut up and forget about it, girl, and mind your place here. And we helped her to desert. Our group helped her to desert, and she's now living in the Netherlands. I also interview an Iraqi student whose family was brutalized by American soldiers over some mistaken identity. They got the wrong family and totally tore the house apart and humiliated them. Her brother is now a resistance fighter. He wasn't before, but he joined the resistance because of this incident.
Well, just backing up a moment, you said that there were two main groups of anti-war activists that you were portraying in this this book, and of the first sort that you posited Trucker as an example of the saboteur going around destroying army vehicles and things. What is the broad category of the second type of activist?
Well, the second group takes a very different approach. They feel that to really change the system, we need to change the collective consciousness that has produced it. until recently, changing that seemed impossible. But now techniques are available that enable us to directly influence the collective consciousness. It sounds a bit strange, but particularly in Japan, with its tradition with the Buddhist tradition there, it will strike a chord in people. The ancient Vedic civilization had meditation techniques that kept the peace, and these have been rediscovered and are being used today. The basic principle is that when large numbers of people practice transcendental meditation together, peace occurs automatically. And not just for the people meditating, but the whole society becomes peaceful through them. And so this second part of the book portrays this group and discusses there have been 23 studies now in academic journals that show that large groups of meditators reduce violence and improve the quality of life in the whole surrounding area. And during every one of these assemblies, large thousands of people got together to do transcendental meditation. Crime and violence and accidents in the entire region dropped, and the quality of life index rose. So this group takes a more positive approach. The first group is, their disadvantage is that it's rather negative, and it's polarizing to people, But this group takes what seems to me gets at this problem from a deeper level of our collective consciousness. It's quite astounding the effects on war during these large groups where thousands of people were meditating together. Terrorism and casualties in the region dropped by 70%, and the levels of fighting dropped by 50%. But then after the assemblies ended, the figures returned to their previous levels. And these studies, they go against the standard Western materialist view of the world. They show that there's a deeper level to the universe than Western science, at least Western science in its current version, can explain. And so a lot of people are very skeptical about this. But before these studies were published in the academic journals, they were peer-reviewed by independent scientists who had nothing to do with meditation. And they said, well, a lot of them said, we can't understand the principles, but this research is valid, so we'll publish it. My personal experience was I attended two of these assemblies where thousands of people were together, and the experiences were wonderful. It really deepens the results having a large group there. You can feel the mental emanations reinforcing one another. Because the techniques work from the level of collective consciousness where all our minds are linked. Our individual minds aren't fundamentally separated, but we share a deeper dimension in common, and something people intuitively sense, but it's not part of our Western paradigm, our Western view of way of looking at the world. But science now is becoming more and more interested in researching consciousness, both in individuals and in groups, and they're finding we all send mental energy through this field of consciousness that connects us, and everyone is continually transmitting and receiving these influences. But the mental atmosphere we share is loaded with them, and they're often broadcasting a program of fear, frustration, anger, and aggression. You can feel that particularly in a big city. This is a toxicity in the collective consciousness, and it results in cloudy thinking and harmful action. It really affects the way we think. And it's particularly if you don't live in a big city, if you live in a peaceful country area, you go into the big city suddenly, you can feel the change. It's harder to think there. There's so much going on. And under this pressure, under this collective stress, people become prone to hostility, accidents, and crime. And as the negative atmosphere, the mental atmosphere we share builds up, the pressures mount, groups of people then turn to the mass insanity of warfare. But these large groups of meditators can counteract that. They have the ability to bring their thinking mind to this deeper dimension of transcendental consciousness. And they can think from that level where all our minds are joined. And from there, their minds have great power. So when a large group of meditators reaches that level together, their mental energies reinforce one another into a surge of positivity that overrides the stress of the surrounding population. And the minds of everyone in the area receive a broadcast of coherence from them. It's a life-nurturing energy that heals the collective consciousness of fear and hostility before those negative forces can build up and erupt into crime and war. It creates an influence of peace and orderliness and harmony. It sounds bizarre.
Yes, it does.
But so did a lot of other important discoveries at the time they were made. The research is well worth looking into. There's a website about it called permanentpeace.org. permanentpeace.org that goes into the research. And the goal now is to, what they found is that if 8,000 people are together meditating for several hours a day, the effect can be global. The effect can affect wars halfway around the world.
Precisely 8,000. That's a very precise number.
Well, that seems to be, somewhere in that area.
Oh, I see. So it's not actually a number. It's just something that you made up.
It's something that they found empirically. If it's less than that, if the groups are less than that, it doesn't have the global effect.
7,999 is not enough.
Well, that probably would be. But if you get like 6,000, it will have...
So 5,999 is not enough. You'll forgive my cynicism, but obviously this is not an empirical study that you're talking about, since you can't actually cite the number.
Well, the numbers are very difficult to quantify to that degree.
So you will admit that you just made up a number when you were saying 8,000?
No, I will admit that that in these studies, they found that somewhere in the neighborhood of 8,000 was enough to trigger this other effect.
So can you cite which particular study has this 8,000 number so we can go and take a look at it?
Well, it's all on this permanentpeace.org. They list the studies there and describe them as to where they were. These were studies that were done in North America and in Europe and in India. And they're, but you know, each time they would have different numbers, and the numbers can vary, you know, from day to day and week to week. So it's hard to come up with a real precise quantification of this, but it's still at this very early stages. What we're saying now is that there's enough evidence that some effect is happening from these large groups of people that let's build a permanent group of 8,000 meditators in one place and see what happens. It won't cost that much, and there's nothing to lose, and it could quite possibly bring world peace. It's certainly worth a try. And that's the...
It may indeed be, but you'll forgive my cynicism. I personally don't practice transcendental meditation, and I don't... I've never taken a look at these studies, I must admit, so I will take a look at those studies that you mentioned. But it kind of leaves the people who are not on that boat kind of looking at this askance and wondering what their position in all of this. I suppose if 8,000 people want to gather together and practice this, that's fine by me. I have no qualms about that, and hopefully it will bring peace to the world. But in case it doesn't, perhaps those of us on the outside might have some place in this. I'm just trying to wonder what my place in this might be.
Well, it's been shown that now we have, there's 4,000 people in India, a group of 4,000 in India, and 2,000 in the United States, in the middle of the United States in Iowa, and trying in both places to build up to 8,000. And we'll see. We'll see what happens. But it's, you know, this kind of skepticism is certainly understandable, but it's the same kind of skepticism that has greeted other really important changes. Like when it was first discovered that the Earth moves around the sun, this was considered a very strange idea. But after a while, it became accepted, and it seems to me...
But the strangeness of an idea does not necessarily mean that it is going to be accepted. I mean, there have been a lot of strange ideas that were not accepted.
Never got accepted, yeah. And we'll have to see. But so far, the evidence is very impressive that something's happening there, and we should investigate it further. And one of the reasons, you know, one of the chief things I kept running into in my peace research is that so many people are convinced that war is a part of human nature, and that it's built into us and we can't do anything about it. It's always going to be that way. And this research shows otherwise, and a lot of other historical facts show that there are that peace is definitely possible, that we really can have peace, and that this this idea that war is inevitable is generated by aggressive personality types who view the world that way. But there's the early, in our civilization, that's true. When you look back at the history of patriarchal civilization, there have been wars all the time. But the early matriarchal civilization of Southeastern Europe enjoyed centuries of peace. There's a wonderful book, The Civilization of the Goddess, that goes into that. And there has been no sign of wars in other cultures. But those, like the Pacific Islands and everything, those were primarily matriarchal cultures. And they had enough, they were low-stress societies. They had enough resources to sustain themselves without having to conquer others. So they weren't under huge amounts of stress. And it's the stress factor that drives us. And stress is built into capitalism. Capitalism creates artificial shortages that makes people scramble for them. And so if we can eliminate the stress factor, and that's one of the things that the meditation does, we have a good chance of achieving peace.
So what economic system would this system of meditation exclude and include? If capitalism is not amenable to this, then?
What I'm saying about capitalism is my own view. There are plenty of people who meditate who are pro-capitalists and say, well, that's perfectly compatible. I myself am a socialist. I really believe that that capitalism is inherently flawed and has certainly served a purpose. It certainly was an improvement over feudalism, but now it's run its course and is becoming a destructive force in the world. And until we, in the current stage where it's consolidating into these massive multinational corporations who are fighting it out, the people are getting are really getting squashed by this system. So
you believe that the state should initiate violence against people to take more of their earnings in order to distribute them to other people? Isn't that the kind of underlying violence that we're trying to eradicate when we talk about this?
No, well, I think that's a false view of socialism. Socialism doesn't have to mean that at all. That's an accurate description of what happened in the Soviet Union to an extent. It's not entirely accurate. But we can build a society that the basic principle of socialism is that the resources of the world belong to the people of the world and should be used for their benefit and not for the private profit of an owner class. But of course, we could talk about this for a long time, and it's an important issue. But I'm convinced we can build a democratic socialist society where we share and everybody has enough, but nobody is hoarding resources.
Hoarding is in the eye of the beholder. I think it comes down to the ultimate definition of property and how we go about defining what that is and whether it exists and how it should exist. So I get very hesitant when I hear people talking about, well, we have to get those hoarders and we have to go after them. And of course, that means the initiation of violence. And that's where it comes down to, because violence is always initiated by people who believe and feel that they're doing the right thing. It's for the good of humanity that we have to slaughter these tens of millions of people like Mao did or like Stalin did. repeated over and over and over and over again throughout history. People have died in the name of these ideas and these utopias and these socialist dreams. But I honestly think that that underlying idea that violence can be used and initiated in order to take something away from someone else because clearly they have too much of it is itself the underlying violence that has to be eradicated before we can begin to talk about peace on any other type of societal level.
Well, that's an eloquent statement, James. That's really an eloquent statement. Where I differ with you, though, is probably on the definition of violence. To me, it's not violence to say this factory now belongs to the people who are working in it, and not to the quote unquote owners of it. We're now the owners. And taking it away, to me, that's not violence. I don't consider seizing property to be violence. I think of violence as harmful to, as doing physical harm to other human beings or other living creatures.
Well, I'm sorry to have to break this to you, William, but in fact, I've now declared that your house is now the property of anyone who wants to live there. So I'll go and publish the address for everyone, and they can all go and converge on your house. And it's not violence to if they just come and start to eat your food and, you know, live there in your house. I mean, it's not violence, so you can't have any argument against that.
Well, that's one way to look at it, but no one is proposing that. There's a difference between a person's house and massive corporations that control resources that are needed by all the people of the world.
Indeed true. And corporations, of course, are only a legal fiction that was created through the gears and apparatus of the state itself. So I must be very clear that I'm not in any way arguing for the legal rights of these legal fictions that don't actually exist. But for when it starts to affect real human beings is when I get concerned.
Well, I would agree with you, but it doesn't seem to me there's any way to have capitalism in its current state. Capitalism is inevitably going to consolidate into these massive corporations. That's the nature of the system. It builds up and builds up and eliminates the less effective predators, and the big fish eat the little fish. And so now we're staring at ExxonMobil and...
Right. But a corporation only exists because, I mean, all that means is that the people who are the directors of the company and the board, on the board, get to deflect their and absolve their own personal responsibility and liability in what they're doing. And that's only perpetuated by a legal system that is undergirded by the entire infrastructure of the state, which itself is this ultimate bastion of violence, which perpetuates all of the other forms of violence. Without the state itself, none of this would be possible. So I think perhaps I would humbly suggest you're looking in the wrong place for where the root cause, the underlying cause of this violence is, and what the ultimate solution would then be.
James, it sounds like you're an anarchist. It sounds like
it sounds that way, doesn't it?
And that's a great tradition. That's a great tradition. It's a tradition that's also active on the left, though. Saying that the key aspect that what appeals to me about libertarianism is this idea of reducing the power that comes down on us as individuals and constrains our lives, reducing that to the minimum. And they say, well, let's get rid of the government then. But the real power, it's what seems to me, that's coming down on us that constrains our lives is the business apparatus that forces us to work for low wages, that gobbles up huge amounts of our time, that forces us to generate profits for the owners. And that's much more of an oppressor than the government. The government is the tool that the business interests used to administer themselves. And so if we really want to talk about reducing coercion, we got to change the economic system too, not just get rid of the government.
Well, that would be like saying, well, it would be like blaming humanity for having the need to eat or something. I mean, it would be great if we did live in Eden and we could just, you know, we would never have to worry about food or clothing or that. But given that we do live in a world in which we do actually have to do something in order to gain the sustenance from which we live, I don't think that that's too much to ask. And of course, there are those who are incapable of that, and the people who can't physically can't work or things of that nature. But of course, that's where private charity comes in. I still don't see why we would need a governmental apparatus in order to initiate the violence, which inevitably is used to extract the taxation in whatever form that is in order to distribute that wealth.
Well, you could be right, and I would hope that would prove to be right, because it could certainly be better than what we've got now. let's put it that way. And this idea of violence, so would you consider the burning the trucks, burning the military trucks, to be violence?
I would consider that not only, I mean, it's not only a form of violence. I understand the idea behind it, but I think it's actually counterproductive and actually kind of quite stupid in a certain sense, because of course the government doesn't care in the least if they lose a truck here and there. They're using this money that they create out of nothing through the phony central banking fraud that's been perpetuated on the people for centuries, which is really just it's money drawn on the back of the people themselves, their productive capacity in the future, that then they use this funny money that they've created out of nothing to buy more, and it really only empowers the corporations that are behind the entire war state anyways. So it's not only stupid, it's actually counterproductive.
Well, Trucker would say that, yeah, just him doing it here and there doesn't make much difference, but he's saying if thousands of people are out there destroying military equipment, that the government can't afford infinite expenditures for this war.
Why not? They created out of nothing. They can afford whatever they want to afford. It's created on the back of our burden to pay that debt. So in the sense that they can't infinitely tax us, I suppose that's the case. But to a large extent, it really does nothing to stop the root cause of the problem, which is why I think targeting the actual military people themselves and saying, you should not be doing this, and trying to convince them of that is infinitely more productive than blowing up trucks.
But can they be convinced? We think they would have been convinced by now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there you go. There is a certain percentage that not only go along with it, but obviously actively participate in it. And perhaps that speaks to something more underlying than just the fact that they have these tools at their disposal.
Another guy we portrayed in the book is a janitor who works for a janitorial service company, and one of their clients is a defense contractor. And he destroyed their computers, made it seem like an electrical surge, and destroyed their computers at the defense contractor. And I guess, would you put that in the same category? I guess, it's just one action. It's no big deal. But he felt it really set back the war effort to a certain extent. But is that violence also?
There can be creative ways in which to take down that system from within, and I'm not against that particularly. I just think that and those things can be argued on a case-by-case basis for their merits, but I think there has to be a more underlying solution than going after the sort of the technical infrastructure, because I don't think, unless it was done all in one go and, you know, millions of pieces of infrastructure were destroyed overnight or something, I don't think it's going to have that fundamental effect. And certainly in the case of someone who may be in a position to, I don't know, destroy a drone before it can, you know, kill an Afghan wedding party or whatever the case may be, right? I think we can imagine scenarios in which that might be more productive than counterproductive. But I think just as a strategy, I don't think it's going to be the answer.
Yeah, it's definitely not the answer. There is no the answer. It's going to take a movement on in many directions. And in the book, we try to portray some of those directions. Another example of property destruction was a young woman whose friend returned, an ex-boyfriend returned home from Iraq crippled. He lost his leg there. And she was so angered by this that she hurled a rock through the window of the local recruiting officer. And that created quite a controversy in the community. And And she, at first she was scared. She did when she was in a fit of anger. But then later she realized, well, this makes a difference because it shows people aren't putting up with this. They're not just sitting back there and forgetting about it. People see the boarded up window at the recruiting office and they think twice about going in because they realize, well, some people are against this. And that's also a form of violence, but it was sort of her way of taking revenge on the military for what they did to her, for what happened to her friend.
Well, there is a long and rich history of civil disobedience and noncompliance of all different stripes and sorts that have had a demonstrated effect on in that capacity in the past. So I wouldn't dismiss it as a strategy in that regard. But again, I think I'm more in tune along the lines of what you were talking about earlier, even though I'm not particularly an adherent to transcendental meditation. Also, I'm not a materialist. I don't believe that the only things in the world are those that we can touch, taste, see, smell, or hear. And I think there must be something to the idea that human nature, quote unquote, is malleable, and there must be some way that we can see the world that that is not necessarily predicated on war. I think there has to be something else than that. But I'm just particularly skeptical about the meditation part of it. But then again, I'm also not opposed to anyone who wants to try that out and get into some sort of group to try that out and see if they can affect world peace by closing their eyes and humming.
Well, it's not a hum. It's a changing the brain waves. It alters the brain waves into more coherent patterns that go across both halves, both hemispheres of the brain. And when you get thousands of people doing this in the same room, it reinforces one another. They become this kind of coherent reinforcement that apparently can affect people outside it. Because on this, it's like a radio broadcaster, like we're doing now, sending out waves through the electromagnetic field and affecting things far, far distant. The transmitter sends it one place and a receiver 100 miles away picks it up. And the human mind is somewhat similar to that through this field of consciousness that in a way is similar to this electromagnetic field. These invisible fields that surround us are more and more becoming the focus of science. Well, what's really going on there? And how can we affect that, and how can we improve our lives by it? You can see that on the more superficial level with things like cell phones and stuff, electrosmog, these issues. But there's also a more subtle underlying area of just the consciousness as a force too.
Well, it is absolutely a fascinating field of research, and whatever my personal degree of incredulity, of course, has absolutely no bearing on whether it's true or false. So once again, I would invite people to check that out for themselves. And that website you were mentioning before was permanentpeace.org?
Permanentpeace.org, yes. Right. And my website is peacewriter.org.
That's right, peacewriter.org. So tell us about some of the other books that you've written.
Well, yeah, the first one was A World of Hurt. And as you mentioned, it's about the psychological roots of war. One of the things I discovered was that war has a lot to do with gender. So the book has to do with the need for patriarchal approval that young men feel, this desire to be accepted into this world of the fathers, and to become one of them, and to get the love that we all crave from our fathers, and most of us apparently got enough of, to be accepted into this hierarchical system. And the military is set up that way. But also, the other factor involved is an emotional blockage that so many of us feel growing up in this culture of being a man. What it means to be a man is you have to shut off a lot of the emotional side of your personality. So the book deals with those things. I was struck one of the reasons I changed and turned against the military was that I realized that the kind of masculinity that's generated there is really toxic. the way soldiers are manufactured is a profoundly a sick process. The military is the most patriarchal institution that we have, and it creates soldiers by turning them into the lowest creature under patriarchy, which is a woman. So they take these young recruits and strip their masculinity and their sense of personal power away. They're made to do the lowliest work and to be obsessed with their appearance, like women are in our society to great measure. And they have to measure up to the approval of these older, more powerful men. You're always being inspected, and they're fanatical about the way you dress and the way you look, how closely shaved you are, and your hair being just right and everything. And so you have to line up in these rows, and these older, powerful men come by and stand right up in your face and look at you, examining you. This male gaze, this predatory gaze that women write about now, and also Foucault, a homosexual man, writing about the assaultive gaze that's inherent in our forms of masculinity. And this creates a rage in these young men, and it rouses their homophobia, and this rage is then given an outlet in the training, and the outlet, of course, is the enemy, attacking those people and projecting that rage, because the system itself is too powerful to oppose, but there's the enemy out there, and you can get them. And also, if you accept your place in the hierarchy, this humiliated lower status, you can then move up. You can then move up and do it to others. So it's a process of taking these normally pretty traditionally male young men, and I'm not sure what it, with women now in this more in the services, this adds another dimension to it. But in the combat units, it's still almost entirely men. And their phallus is then symbolically taken away from them, because they have no power at all. They're continually insulted, and they have to just busy themselves with their appearance and with cleaning things. There's very little actual violence training in the military. It has much more to do with polishing the floors so they look nice. Their phallus is taken away and replaced with a weapon. So instead of being something loving that brings us closer to another person, their sexuality, which should be used to create new life and love in the world, this sexuality becomes a tool for death and destruction of life. So what the military does is it flips sexuality into its opposite. It's profoundly sick. It's a profoundly sick institution. And that's what I tried to get across in A World of Hurt. And then my second book was a young adult novel called C.D. Ring, about a young Chicano boy who's growing up in Los Angeles among that kind of violence. And the third book is called Summer Snow. It's a novel about an American warrior in Central Asia who falls in love with a Sufi mystic. The Sufis, of course, is the mystical strand of Islam. And she shows him an alternative to the military mentality, and changes him so he no longer wants to function as a warrior there. And it's sort of a thriller too. I hope, sort of a philosophical thriller. And then Radical Peace is my fourth book.
Well, fascinating stuff. And there's no doubt that the induction into the armed forces is a type of cult initiation. And certainly all of those aspects of that you've talked about certainly just did not come together by happenstance. Obviously, there's been a lot of thought put into all of the various stages and how they basically break down the psychology of the person being inducted into that. So it is absolutely fascinating. I'd love to read more about that. So once again, William Hathaway of peacewriter.org. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time. time, but a very interesting conversation. So thank you very much for
your...
Yes.
And I think one of the reasons it's interesting is because we have different views on this,
but I
think we've been able to explore our differences in a way that would be helpful to our listeners and
I certainly hope so. I certainly hope so. And my listeners know that not to take my word for anything, and they will look into what you've been talking about. So I'm very much looking forward to hearing some feedback about this interview as well, and hopefully we can have you on again in the future to talk more.
Let's do it, James. Thanks.
All right, William, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah. Bye now.